are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. My guest today is Robert Stone, the author most recently of Outerbridge Reach, published by Tickner and Fields, author as well of Children of Light, A Flag for Sunrise, Dog Soldiers, and A Hall of Mirrors. I wanted to leap into the fray right away. It seems as if the subject of heroism passed over a generation of American writers, that when American writing was dominated, say, by Nabokov et al., certain kinds of what used to be called the larger themes were escaping fiction. And those seem to be your dominant concerns. The argument back then was that fiction really couldn't solve these problems and therefore could only, you know, patrol its own territories. Could you speak a little bit about heroism?
Heroism and the idea of it in America are full of ambiguities. I think there's a way in which the United States, from its founding, has resisted the idea of heroism. I mean, the military ideal in this country is very very different from the military ideal abroad. For example, the great model was Cincinnatus. The idea of was of someone who was a peaceable man who would then put his plow aside and go out and be a hero on the field of battle. In fact, I think there's a very very strong resistance to the heroic mode, to acting out heroic postures. I think this is partly because of the origins of the country in sensibleness. I mean, its foundation by merchants and mechanics and farmers. The traditional heroic mode is on a certain level, I think, despised here. It's one of the reasons I think that people in Latin America and Europe profess such distress with us.
Well, it's an interesting thing to me because in your fiction there's a pairing that I don't find elsewhere. You may be the only writer I know who creates cerebral and violent men. Cerebral violence, it's almost as if by the time you're getting to your novel, this man who lays down his plow and goes out onto the field of battle is someone who doesn't quite remember how to work the plow and doesn't know where the field of battle is. There's a kind of haziness of idealism. I wondered who these figures are now.
You mean figures
in contemporary
in
life?
Contemporary life. Well, I don't know if there ever was. You know, I don't know how much this ideal of Cincinnatus, the part-time hero, corresponds to reality. I think there's this great resistance to the heroic mode because, in a way, regardless of what we say, I think we've made a virtue of mediocrity to a large extent. There is great pressure on Americans not to distinguish themselves. I mean, this is reflected on the absurd and vulgar level of George Bush pretending to like pork rinds. But I mean, there's a certain. Mm-hmm. I mean, this reflects something real. If you look for heroes today, I mean, certainly. I don't think you're likely to find them in politics, and that's been true for a long time. We really do everything we can to eliminate people of any distinction on the level of public life. It's an impulse toward mediocrity, which is not wholly a bad thing. I mean, mediocrity has its positive side, but we don't. Whatever we may say, we really tend to try and diminish our public figures.
Well, from its earliest pages, Outerbridge Reach seems to be about that disappearance of recognizable boundaries. In its very first pages, the winter has given way to a warmth that people attribute to the greenhouse effect, a boat starts to leak. One of its best boats and friends say to one another, as if it were a routine or a commercial they were reciting, nothing works anymore. And they all agree and seem to like saying this. It's about a world in which expected qualities have disappeared and been replaced by public relations and other kinds of similitudes.
Right, that's true, and it is for that reason that in the beginning of the book, you know, we have this sense of something wrong even with the weather. I really mean it to be a story of the 90s, and what my view of America in the 90s keeps coming up in it. And my central character, one of my three major characters, Brown, is a man who has heroic longings. He feels as though there are circumstances which if he were matched with them, he could prevail. He could satisfy himself and his dreams about himself, his own youthful dreams.
Well, it's interesting because in a funny way, I think the question becomes, where is the field of battle? And if a man wants to distinguish himself today, at least this man, Owen Brown, he has to go out and face not an enemy, but the void, the emptiness of the world ocean. And that seems to be almost as if in his hallucinations and visions, he's repopulating the world with islands, with terras incognita, so that he can almost reinvent a possible world for heroism before he parts from it.
I think that's what he's doing. He's a dreamer on one level, who in a way was raised on the stories of late 19th century heroism. I mean, he thinks of Shackleton and people of that mold. One of the phrases that you know, we see coming up a lot is the old phrase of William James, the moral equivalent of war. Brown is a man who saw some combat in Vietnam, and this awoke in him complicated impulses. He's not a war lover, but he really welcomed the opportunity to live as part of a larger cause. In a way, I think that phrase, the moral equivalent of war, is a very interesting one, because it gets trotted out by politicians from time to time, but I don't think they realize what they're saying when they use it. I mean, what William James said in the work that's called The Moral Equivalent of War was that if we are against war, which we must be if we want the world to continue to be a civilized place, then we don't want to see wars breaking out. But on the other hand, James said, war does nevertheless bring out certain positive things, community, bravery, self-sacrifice, courage, all these things which are positive human attributes. And then William James suggested, well, if we as responsible people want to see an end of wars, we must somehow find something that is, as he said, the moral equivalent of war, something that will not subject the world to the horrors of war, but at the same time will bring out community and courage and things like that. So in a way, what Brown is looking for in this book is the moral equivalent of war.
It's an interesting thing. I want to go back a little bit. The last time you and I met each other was at the time The Children of Light had come out. And I had told you that I thought that in a very dark way that it was a dispirited book, that the characters were engaged in a battleground of their own invention. Their engagement was with their own fictions and not with the world. And I think in your own interest in reflecting America, that was very much a time when people were inventing their own stories unpropelled, motivated, unattached to any ostensible reality. And so it was a movie book, but genuinely so, with the hero and heroine, she fighting her own inner demons and hallucinations, him, he was becoming Othello, becoming Hamlet, fighting through a series of roles, most notably Lear, that were never his own. What brought you back in the years between that book and this to this engagement with the physical world? This is a man in the sea novel, but it felt, at least at that time, like you might sink entirely into that internalized universe.
No, I don't think I was going to be condemned to stay there. I really wanted to do that book, Children of Light. I really wanted to do a work reflecting people who make enormous trouble for themselves. In a way, I there was a time when I wanted to call that book. I thought of calling it Death and the Maiden. I mean, the idea of the principal character, Gordon Walker, as a kind of questing knight who brought nothing but trouble with him. I mean, who came basically as a destroyer of this woman who he thought he loved, around whom he had constructed fantasies, as she had, to a degree, constructed fantasies about herself, and the relationship, their relationship to each other, their relationship to the movies that they both worked in. I mean, all these things were very much on my mind. But it was a book I needed to do at that time. I really am happy with it. I know that it was not universally well received, even by people who follow my work and like it. But I'm proud of it. I think it was a good book. But it was an excursion into mere interiority that did not address very much the concerns of the larger world, and I would not have stayed with that subject. I really am just too much interested in all the things you're not supposed to talk about, like politics and religion, to spend all my time or to spend more than one book, I think, with people whose troubles were so discreet, so special to themselves.
And in the process of turning to this book, was there a turning away from the other?
I don't think so, because this was a book where the difficulties of the individuals came very quickly to reflect all the big questions. For one thing, it's a sea story. And sea stories, in a way, by their very nature, bring you into the big picture. They bring you up against elemental questions. As the ocean is this enormous, unforgiving force, things that are true about the ocean, I think, tend to be true about life itself. And with these people having to deal with the ocean, a man reducing his life to the diagram of sky and sea and boat, I think automatically one is speaking in universals.
Well, it's very interesting to me. When I was reading this book, I remembered that story years ago in New American Review, Perché no tiene, perché le falta, in which the porpoise speaks and reveals universals to one of its watchers. And I think it took this long for the sea to have its word and its message given to one of your sufferers.
Right. I always had a fascination with the sea, and that was my dealing with the whole thing on the level of the absurd. I think I have a mantra it's recited in the course of that story that goes, "Surrender to the notion of the motion of the ocean."
That's right.
And I was clowning around with that one, but I always really saw. I spent a lot of time of my young life at sea, and it always meant a lot to me, and I just have a good time invoking it, writing about it, and thinking about it.
I, of course, found myself thinking a lot about Lord Jim in the course of reading this book, especially toward its conclusion. And you've always had a deep relation to Joseph Conrad's work. What's your favorite Conrad? Mine is The Secret Agent, I think, but I wondered You seem more affiliated with the earlier, the Marlowe stuff.
My favorite, I think, of them all is Victory. I really like Axel Heist and the story, the storytelling process. I mean, I love The Secret Agent too. I think that really is one of his very best, and at least the beginning of Under Western Eyes. Mm-hmm. And I think I learned a great deal reading Conrad. I think anybody would learn a great deal. I mean, because you don't learn stylistic lessons from Conrad because his style is literally inimitable. I think you would have to have English as your third language to write to write like Conrad. But one of the things that he was interested in, one of the things his life led him to, was the state of an empire at the height of its power that perhaps was going into some decline. And this is something that he had intimate and firsthand and upfront knowledge of as a sea captain. I think in a way my subject might be said to be the American Imperium at the height of its powers, perhaps at the beginning of its the waning of its relative power. I spent a lot of time at sea, so he really was the master to whom I went for notions of what the novel was supposed to be about. I think I learned a great deal.
I'm talking to Robert Stone, the author of Outer Bridge Reach, published by Tichner and Fields. But Conrad seems to me, after George Eliot, to be the great embodier of moral questions, of what defines humanity and of the relationship of action to thought, which seemed to me to be peculiarly your themes and themes that seem, in the wake of that 19th century novel we were speaking of and its heroism, to have disappeared. And some people would think of these themes as being wholly ambiguous and in these days unembodiable in the action of a novel. And so that's why I always think primarily of Conrad. Hemingway a bit in that question of, you know, what is the morality of style. But Conrad principally.
Well, Conrad was very concerned in a practical and fairly simple way with heroism, and his notions of heroism were fairly conventional. They were certainly imperial virtues. I mean, in The Secret Sharer, of course, he has, you know, his captain, his character is defending another sea captain. I mean, he prevents the prosecution of another sea captain who killed a man who behaved in a cowardly way during a storm. He had a very hard code. He was not a particularly merciful sea captain, we think of. I don't think I would like to have shipped aboard one of his ships. I may admire his novels, but I don't think I'd want him to be captain over me. His sense of the heroic was fairly uncomplicated, and I suppose in a way it is an uncomplicated thing. I find myself certainly in this book speculating on physical courage, on its relationship to moral courage. I have a character say that while you can have moral cowardice along with physical courage, you cannot really have moral courage without physical courage. I have a character maintaining this, and I'm kind of inclined to think that is a melancholy fact. I suspect from what I've seen that may be true, that it's very hard for people to bring moral courage to bear if they don't have physical courage. I don't know why that should be true, but I suspect it might be.
There are these characters in your work, like Strickland in this book, who take charge not of actuality but of representation, and who are aware that things can be made to seem much more malignant and humiliating than they are. But the people who are at the mercy of characters like this eventually seem to become humiliated and weak. Do you take it then that, what, representation, the whole media carnival that goes on in the misrepresentation of this boat, in the misrepresentation of the race, of diaries and logs, actually physically corrupt the character?
I think there's a way in which characters can be made to act in terms of what's expected of them. People who are aware of low expectations of themselves often fulfill the low expectations. I mean, I think that's something that does go on. And there's a kind of obsessive ruthlessness about the character Strickland, his belief that everybody's on the con, that whatever anybody claims to be doing is not what they're really doing. I think with this character, he sometimes hopes on some level that this might not prove to be true, but he really, for the most part, sees it as his job to expose this. He puts the people that he makes documentary films about in an impossible position because, of course, he controls not only what he films but also the way it's cut. So, yeah, there's a way, I think, in which the media attention can be corrupting. I don't think it's quite as simple as, you know, as that, but I think there's a grain of truth in that, that there's a kind of media curse, a media whammy that, you know, that can be put on people who are, I mean, trying to perform. I mean, I have somebody in this book say, you know, there are two sorts of people. There are people who do things, and then there are the people who follow them around, trying, you know, trying to find out where they, you know, why they're imposters, why they're not really doing what they claim to do.
You know what I miss after A Hall of Mirrors, and I was thinking about it last night because people have been comparing you again, and I think for obvious reasons, with Melville. In A Hall of Mirrors, you had a kind of cosmic vaudeville, like the confidence man going on. But in the subsequent books, there's been a harrowing naturalism, but that tries intentionally to stay away from the absurdo-comic and the hallucination enters when the character hallucinates. The world is no longer hallucinatory in these books. How come? I miss the Grand Guignol.
Yeah. Well, I know what you mean. I think I moved toward it to some degree in this one. I have that level of hallucination, a level at which the world threatens to become completely anti-rational, in which it threatens to dissolve there's a moment when whatever sense it makes threatens to disappear completely. But I never since A Hall of Mirrors have I used a completely disintegrating world as I did in that book. And I know what you mean. I think they have been. I mean, there are characters in A Hall of Mirrors who may, for all we know, for all the readers know, be supernatural beings. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of non-realism in it, and I've always seen myself not as a strict realist, as you know. And I think there are sections in Outer Bridge Reach, though, that are also of questionable.
Oh, absolutely, but they accompany the disintegration of Owen's mind.
That's true.
They're reports of what he thinks he sees, right. Whereas in The Hall of Mirrors, the objective world had become a shell game. You know,
right. Well, I may get back to that because there's a level on which that very much attracts me, and I believe it's a true thing. You know, I think the world sometimes does deconstruct itself. In a way, I do this in my short stories. I think I go back to the mode of A Hall of Mirrors more in some of my short stories.
Well, yes, certainly the anonymous caller in the alcoholism story is one of those embodiments of diabolical interference. I wondered, you know. The cover of this book, although it's, I notice it's called Hail and Farewell, and it's from a print by Rockwell Kent, does make me think of Billy Budd, a book to which it's been compared. Did you choose the cover, and could you?
I didn't. I didn't choose it. It was chosen by John Herman, the editor. I had what I had in mind, a Doré drawing of the Ancient Mariner, which of course would, you know, is very striking. But I have to say that I like this cover tremendously. I mean, it just seems as though it were made for this particular book. It just knocks me out. It is haunting, and and who knows exactly what it means, but there does seem to be in the distance here a man up in the shrouds of a boat, and off in the distance there's a town, and the narrative here moves between our main character at sea and his family back home.
Well, the figure cruciform as well, his eyes somewhat hooded, attired in what seems to be a shaft of celestial night in the midst of moonlight, and a Callipygian shapeliness that reminds me of Billy Budd in a novel which also has a stutterer. So I wondered if you'd talk about Billy Budd a bit.
Oh, Billy Budd is a great novel. I think, in fact, I do have somebody refer to Brown here. Well, I have Strickland, his nemesis and his rival for the affections of the principal female character. Strickland refers to Brown as the handsome sailor. So there are certainly echoes of Billy Budd. Billy Budd is a great work, and you know, I'm always have been a great admirer of Melville, as who isn't, as is all the world, I guess.
Well, I wondered, you know, it's a funny kind of question, and I've never had anyone to ask. The books that you write, do they begin in your mind as important novels? You and William Styron seem to be similar as novelists in that the importance of the subjects taken on and the seriousness with which they're engaged almost ensures a certain sobriety in the response to them as well. And I wonder whether this is there at the inception of a book. I can't treat this. This is not important enough. Its themes are not central enough.
Well, I don't think I begin it with a sense of its being, you know, quotes important, unquote. I really start with the people. So, I mean, there are two things that I need to begin, and one is a sense of who the people are, and usually then also the ending. But I try to do the voices, and I really enjoy philosophical and psychological complications, and I put them in there because I enjoy them, and because one of the great pleasures of creating characters and writing a novel is putting people up against life. But I don't do it with any kind of premeditation, you know, that this is going to be an important book. It's a book about, you know, any book I'm writing is what I'm writing at the time, and I take my pleasures where I find them when I'm writing it. But I don't set out to write quotes important books, unquote.
But you manage to.
Well, I have a weakness for big questions.
I've been talking to Robert Stone, the author most recently of Outerbridge Reach, on the New York Times bestseller list and published recently by Tickner and Fields. And thank you for coming to talk to us today again.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when nights were books.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.